Okay, so we are starting a lesson that will take several weeks. I always assume that it will take half as many weeks as it ends up taking, but the title of this lesson is Rethinking Race. Now, as you heard, if you were here last week, and by the way, if you were not here last week, I would strongly encourage you to listen because that lesson gives a really important context for the whole lesson. But as you heard last week, this lesson began with a question that I asked our post-election team in late November of last year. And that is, what is a Christian response to the election of 2016? What is a Christian response to the ugliness that led up to the election? And what is a Christian response to the ugliness that has continued since the election? Also, last week, I admitted to you that I have been remiss in my role of storytelling in our community. I haven't told the story well of the work that we have been doing to grapple with this question. So really, please do listen to last week. I think you'll find it both informative and encouraging because many of us have been doing some really good work helping us discern our Christian response and act on our Christian response to this historical moment. Last week, I acknowledged that as a community, we're a little bit discouraged, worn out by the tumult of the last couple years. That's not just true of our community, it's true of our nation. It's true at our jobs, our families, but it's true here in our spiritual community. Several from across a wide spectrum of conviction, people who don't agree on much at all, have all agreed about this one thing. We've been doing it wrong. Doug's been doing it wrong. We've been pandering to the left or we've been pandering to the right. We've been too silent or we've been too vocal. We've been too assertive or we've not been assertive enough. We've missed this essential theme of the spiritual tradition or we've missed that essential theme. We should have deleted those ugly Facebook posts so we weren't hijacked by people who aren't engaged in the process working together, or we should have left those ugly posts up because that way we will know what's going on and so we can address it. And I suspect that all those perspectives contain some truth. I'm not sure on any given day which truth is the truest, sometimes one, sometimes the other, sometimes both at the same time. But here's the thing that's kind of encouraging about all of that. This is what happens in historical moments like the one that we're living through. And the fact that all this stuff is stirring up is really okay. It is what happens in historical moments like the one that we're living through, which makes it really okay. And actually, I'm going to explain to you in a moment, it's really kind of good news that this is going on. Because what it indicates is it indicates a great deal of deep conviction, which is necessary if we are going to navigate this historical moment well. We're taking it seriously. That's good news. Also, you can't live through historical moments like this one without tumult. Tumult is how this kind of historical change happens. The historical change that we all long for happens just like this. That's how it unfolds. Society is going to be different in some number of decades, and now is when we're hammering out that new world. This kind of tumult is what it looks like when you're hammering out a new world for us to live in. That's good news. Also, things are more hopeful than they appear to many. A big part of our nation's shared afflictive emotion right now is this: our problems seem so big and we feel so small. In particular, the problem of race seems so big and we feel so small. It seems to many that big social institutions should be working on this, but our social institutions are broken. Congress, for example, should be working on this, but Congress is dysfunctional, bought and paid for by some PAC. The day that they arrive, they have to start raising money for the next election. Or business. Business should be working on this big problem. Or education. Or religion, some institution that's large enough for a problem that's this big. But our social institutions are broken. Now that seems like a bad thing. I want to make the case that it's not all that bad. Social institutions do break down in times of historical change like this one. It's the very breaking of the institution that paves the way for the magnitude of change that we need. Now that's a historical perspective. That's a flying over this thing at 50,000 feet perspective. But it's not an easy perspective to hold on to day in and day out, because every day when you're living your life and I'm living my life, broken institutions just keep scrolling across our screens. We know the enormity of our problems. We see the enormity in particular of our racial problems, but the institutions that fix things are broken. So we feel helpless. We feel hopeless and we feel powerless. We feel a whole bunch of thing under the thing kinds of feelings, but we don't name them. We don't know what they are. And so eventually get to the place where they boil over. And when that happens, we call that experience of unprocessed emotions boiling over, we call that experience anger, which we've been learning as we've been doing self-awareness and self-disclosure isn't a particularly helpful thing for helping us to discern the thing that's under the thing. It's a real feeling, it's a powerful feeling, but it isn't a very helpful thing for discerning what's going on under the surface. But, again, let's be encouraged, because broken institutions are not a bad thing, because they're not actually a limiting thing. If this is one of those every 500-year seismic social change moments in history, then the best thing that our institutions can do for us is break down. In historical moments like this, the biggest changes don't happen in big institutions, because big institutions get stuck in the way things are. Big institutions have a vested interest in keeping things the way that they have been. They can't see the way things will be, or even the way that things must be, because of their vested interest in keeping the status quo humming along. And the good news is, historical change doesn't happen that way anyway. Deep historical change happens in smaller offshoot contexts among people who are not at the center of power, among people who are solving problems while not being vested in maintaining the status quo. Interestingly, people like us, people without a vested interest in keeping things as they have been, people freer from existing norms and existing practices, free to explore new ways of thinking, new ways of feeling, new ways of seeing, people free to explore new ways of acting and reacting, organizing new ways of being. Historical moments like ours are moments of seismic change. And interestingly, one of the first that I studied was going on at the time of Jesus. That was a time in which institutions could not usher in the change that was necessary for the new world that was about to emerge. And so consequently, at that time, they went to smaller organizational units to explore and discover and share that which is necessary for the world that we long to see. Jesus said it this way, "Look to the yeast." That's a better metaphor. Look to the mustard seed, the smaller, the seemingly weak thing. Don't look to the Sanhedrin, and don't look to the Roman Empire, because those institutions have a vested interest in keeping the status quo. Think, Jesus said, single cell. Begin with a person who gains eyes to see and ears to hear. And that person tells a story to somebody else. Now there are two. And then there are four. And then there are eight. And soon the whole loaf is leavened. And soon the whole hillside is covered by mustard plants. And soon the whole society is transformed from the inside out. Institutions don't transform society as much as they administer a transformation that has already happened. Neither do individuals transform society. Their role is to fertilize a transformation that will eventually grow into overtaking a society. That means it's not your job as an individual, it's not my job as an individual, it's not our job as a community to solve our nation's intractable problem of racial inequity. Our job is to listen carefully and obey tenaciously. Our job is to move toward the problem instead of shying away from the problem. Our job is to move into the situation and try to discern and discover and recognize and perceive and learn and then act on what we discern and discover and recognize and perceive and learn. Now that can feel weak and that can feel ineffectual. It can feel like we're whistling past the graveyard, but that's actually how historical change happens generation after generation. And here's the thing that I find particularly encouraging. We're not alone. Across the nation, people like us are doing the same kind of work that we are. I read them. You do too. Together, we're being yeasts, leavening the whole loaf. New systems are even now being fertilized to be born. They're going to replace the old and the broken systems. Right now, what will become our new institutions or our newly awakened institutions are being fertilized. They're becoming zygotes. Then they'll become embryos. Then they will become infants, and they will birth the new world that we long to see. Throughout history, that's the way seismic transformative change happens again and again, which makes this tumult that we're going through really good news. And we, our NRCC community, is right in the thick of it. So even though I find that all very encouraging, I know that the demands of this moment are wearying, and we might be tempted to withdraw from the progress just from exhaustion. Being overrun by fatigue or being overrun by fear, being exhausted by outrage, being exhausted by our anger, it would be a tragedy if we were to withdraw from the process because there is more hope than we usually see. Not one of us, white, black, otherwise, not one of us is not being hurt by the state of race in our nation. Not one of us is not being diminished by the state of race in our nation. Not one of us isn't being negatively impacted by the state of racial relationships in our nations. And that's true of all of our families and our city and our schools and our neighborhoods and our own church. So when we find our way forward, the release that will result, the freedom and the healing and the hope that will be released in us and then through us to others around us will be profound in its timeliness because we are being diminished by the state of race in our lives. So, I think our community is right at that place before a hyperbolic curve takes off. We've done a lot of the get-ready work. We've done a lot of the emotional preparedness work, the emotional capacity work, the self-awareness, self-disclosure, conflict resolution, the work that readies us to do the work that is set before our generation. We're ready to do it and do it well. I imagine that this song will be something that we sing as the lesson unfolds again. It's a Jackson Browne song, "The Unpaid Debts of History." The open wounds of time, the laws of human nature always tugging from behind. That's the state of racial inequity in our nation right now. Unpaid debts, open wounds, human nature. That's tough work, dealing with unpaid debts, open wounds, and human nature. But it is also work we're ready for. It's also work that we as a community can do. I closed last week with a reference to the story of Esther in the Bible. And in that story, Esther's uncle said something to her at a critical moment in their nation's history. He said, "You're ready for this, sweetie. In fact, you're in this position for such a time as this." And I said last week, I think that's us. I think we are ready for this historical moment. So yes, I am encouraged. But encouraging is not synonymous with easy. The work of rethinking race is demanding. It will, we said last week, demand that we bring our very best selves to this endeavor. So I want to start with the term that I borrowed from the title of this book I suggested we read over the summer, America's Original Sin. I am not unaware that the word sin is a loaded term. Once we frame race in our nation using that word, once we frame racial inequity in our nation using that word, a loaded term like sin, things get very problematic very quickly because we Western Christians have painted ourselves into a corner with that word. I want to tell you a little bit about how that happened. It started innocently enough. We did what we always do. We move into a new culture, we Christians. We move into a new language. We move into a new society. And when we do, we adapt our spiritual narrative so that it works in the new culture, so that it fits the sensibilities of people who live in that new culture. Well, one of the earliest times that we did that, one of the earliest instances of that process, was when we, our tradition, moved from Jerusalem to Rome. When we did, we adapted how we tell the story of God. We adapted it from an Eastern Hebrew worldview into a Western Greco-Roman worldview. And when we did that, we moved into a much more individualized society than we'd come from. In this Greco-Roman society, each person was a discrete, separate entity and valued as such. Well, kind of valued as such. They were valued as such if they owned land, and they were valued as such if they were Roman citizens, and they valued as such if they were free and not enslaved, and they were valued as such if they were male. So, separate, discrete, landowning, non-slave, males, yes, highly valued as organizing units for the society. The Greco-Roman world honored this special category of individual higher than the collective whole of the whole system, the whole group. Now, that trend of individualizing only accelerated as the centuries went ticking by. Western individualism really took off after the Renaissance. And Western Christian religion that has been delivered to you and me has been profoundly impacted by this intense individualizing of the experience. So we go to church and we hear a message of God and we hear a message of sin or salvation and we hear it through the lens of this Western individual construct that defines who we are. So that trend of individualizing has become so intensified and so internalized that when we hear the word sin, we don't know what it means to understand that word in terms that Jesus or Paul or our sacred texts would have understood. For us, the visceral instinct around the word sin means something that you do or something that I do. For them, it meant something that we do together, as a group, as a people, as a tribe, as a nation. Sure, we each have a part in the bigger picture. We think about our own words, we think about our own deeds, our own actions, and our own reactions. But Jesus was so fully integrated into the world of groups, the world of we, and the world of together, that that informed his view of the word sin. Same was true for Paul. The same was true for our texts. They live in a collective world, a world of integrated usness. Now, we saw last year in the lesson on Amos that to speak of sin was to speak of the cumulative impact of our individual actions on the cohesion of the group. We see sin as an individual action, our own act of selfishness, our own act of blindness. But they saw it as the collective impact of the whole. Sin described how collectively we impact the world around us. It described how we act, not just as a part, but as the whole. How we impact, not just as a part, but as a whole. It described the whole bearing the brunt of collective action. Now, that's a much more holistic view of the human experience that they had than we do. It tapped into this interconnected oneness as part of the human condition. When we're not blinded by Western individualism, the reality is we are connected to each other. No one of us is an island. Every one of us impacts and is impacted by the others. Well, that little bit, that few paragraphs, kind of matters for this lesson on race, because we're not going to explore individual racial bigotry. We're not going to explore individual racial prejudice. If you feel an inner conviction about your own hatred or your own prejudice, by all means, make a prayer of repentance. Engage in the spiritual process, awaken from darkness into light. But that's not going to be what we're going to be talking about. Next week, we're going to explore a significant theme that Jesus taught us that begins with the Greek word metanoia. Jesus used that word right at the beginning of his ministry. Metanoia, he said, because the God kingdom is nearby. Metanoia, he said, do this metanoia thing because the God community is at hand. Metanoia, he said, because God family is about to take shape. It's as near can be. It's so near, it's in you. It's in your hands. It's in your heart. So do this thing. Do this metanoia thing because it is so close. Now, that word, metanoia, roughly translates to change the path that you've been walking on and walk a different path. That's about what it means. So change the path that you've been walking on, walk a different path because the God family is about to unfold right in your midst, is what Jesus was saying. So we hear Jesus say that when we do this metanoia thing, this walking a different path than we've been walking thing, we hear it often as individuals. Oh, Jesus is telling me I should do something different than I have done before. But the way that Jesus framed this was more of a we than a me way. When Western Christians hear this call to walk a different path, we hear it about me. If I'm going to walk a different path around race, that means that I've got to stop hating people from another group. I got to stop mistreating people from another race. I got to stop being a bigot, and I've got to stop being hateful, and I've got to stop being prejudiced, which again is a true truth. But if we're going to follow Jesus as individuals, as opposed to a part of the collective whole, we're going to miss the point. We must work on our own hearts to rectify what is wrong. True, true, true. But that misses the important point of what Jesus was saying. His point was that sin, including the sin of racial inequity, is not an issue of an individual do or don't. It's an issue of a collective do or don't. So, doing this metanoia, walking a different path thing that Jesus taught us to do, means that after we deal with our own hearts, we must start working toward collective social change. That's what Jesus was saying. We have to start working on we after we've been working on me. I remember several years ago when I first kind of got this point, when a person of color, a friend of mine, was insisting that he was right to call me a racist. Not because of any bad behavior on my part that he could point to, not because of any bad behavior that I could point to on my own part, but because I was a normal white guy and because I thought my normal white guy world was a normal world. Remember the week after Charlottesville, I told the story about my son sneaking out at 2 o'clock in the morning to do some mischief, and a police officer, to whom I'll always be grateful, brought him home and said, "Dad, you better straighten this kid out before he gets in some real trouble." And at that lesson, I contrasted my experience with the experience of a dad who had a black teenager. If we stand back from the normalness of our own experiences, we start to think how it might be, and then we start to feel what it might feel to be a different dad, to be a dad who has a black teenager. And then we can imagine how it must feel for that dad who has a black teenager to see me living in my world with my white teenager, and how it goes so differently for me than it does for him. And when we take that experience and we multiply it times 1,000 different experiences that follow the same pattern, the different feelings that get involved, the different stories that get told, the code word that we are now using as a culture to describe the gap between those two experiences is racism, which has very little to do with individual acts of meanness, which has very little to do with individual acts of bigotry. I have had a lifetime of mostly positive experiences with social institutions, with the exception of customer service. I've had positive experiences with courts and with schools, with traffic stops, with college tutors, with hiring managers. And so because I've had these positive experiences with institutions, that just seems normal to me. I assume that my experiences are just the way it is. And it's just the easiness with which I fall into that assumption, the easiness with which I assume that that experience that I have is the normal experience, that my friend insists is worthy of the word racism or racist. Metanoia, changing the path, it isn't about backtracking from an individual act that I have done. It is that, but that's just a sliver of it. There is so much more. It isn't about backtracking from an individual instance of mean-spiritedness. It is that, but that's not the point. The point is that we are all part of a collective whole. And when the collective whole harms one among us, we together must do the metanoia thing. We must do it as a group of we. And we must undo the harm that our collective decisions and our collective assumptions and our collective words and our collective actions have perpetrated on any among us who are harmed by the process. And that, my friend said, is what the sin of racism means. And that, he said, is why I think it's right for me to call you a racist, even though you're my friend, even though you're a nice guy, and even though our families have been friends for a long time. And if we look into the meaning of our Christian scriptures, that would be the way racism would be defined by Jesus and Amos and our whole tradition. There is a path that is set before us if we count ourselves followers of the Judeo-Christian way. It is a way of collective righting of wrong and doing it not just as individuals, but as a whole. In other words, it won't just do to repent of my own bigotry. We must begin to create a world that is transformed if we're going to follow the Jesus path of metanoia. Now, I know our community pretty well, and I don't know many prejudiced bigots who are part of NRCC. Matter of fact, I don't know one. You might be harboring a secret hatred of some other race, but if you are, you're keeping the secret pretty well. I don't know anyone among us who is a mean-spirited bigot who hates someone just because of their race. As a group, we do care about the poor, despite the caricature that some people wouldn't. I don't know anyone interested in skewing tax policy or skewing health care policy as a code word for disadvantaging one class or disadvantaging a race of people and advantaging themselves. I don't know anyone who is heartless toward the plight of the vulnerable. I've talked to you at length. Bigoted, selfish, prejudiced, this does not describe our community. Consequently, it can become very easy to get lulled into dismissing the issue of race, because our view of sin has been skewed by the marriage of our religious tradition and Western thought. And when we put those two things together, our definitions have become skewed, and consequently, it feels easy to feel unjustly accused when someone calls us a racist because we're not mean-spirited, because we're not bigoted. And so, for us to move forward on this journey will demand of us exploring our definitions. It will demand of us looking beyond the blinders that have been imposed on us that says racism is just this thing that you do as an individual. It isn't. So if we're going to access the ancient wisdom of our tradition, we're going to tap into this word metanoia. We're going to do it because it is the gateway through which we must walk if we want the world on the other side, the world that we long to see. This idea of stepping back from a path and walking a different one, not as individuals, but as a collective whole, a whole society, a whole tribe, a whole group, a whole nation. If we are going to experience this world on the other side that we long for, the one that this tumult that we're going through is hammering out, if we're going to experience it, the gate through which we must walk, the path that is set before us, is us together collectively working for the righting of what has gone wrong, for the walking of a new path. Well, again, the encouraging part is, I think as a community we're ready for this. I think we can do this. I think we have the tools that are in our toolbox. We're capable. We're ready. We can do this. So we'll pick up here next time, and we'll explore this Christian response to our nation's original sin, and we've got to see what the path has been that we have walked on so that we know what path we must backtrack from and move differently. So Spirit of God, may we be shapers of this God kingdom. May we be makers of this God community. May we be creators of this God family, not just in this church building, but in this world, in this society that is ours. Be that so in us, Lord, and may that flow through us, that we would be makers of the beloved community. In Jesus' name, amen.